Hey, Larry.
Hi, Andy.
How's it going?
It could be worse.
Definitely. Couldn't it always be worse? You could be a chemical weapons facility in Syria.
Yes, I suppose so.
See, if you were that, you wouldn't be doing so well.
But I could be a 25-year-old with perfect health and starting a new journey in life rather than being 95 and being at the end of the journey.
If you believe in those kind of processes, we could probably get you to the 25 faster than you think.
All righty.
Deepak Chopra, man, we could reincarnate you.
So,
On the Narsal call the other night, which was a really good call, but this lady, I want to talk about this for a minute if you don't mind. This lady called in, and I'm probably going to screw up kind of the details, but conceptually, she didn't have custody of her kid. And her kid had sex with, I think, another kid, and she didn't report it. Sometime later, a month or whatever that time frame is, the cops come and question her about it because she did report it after whatever that time frame is. But they come and question her about it, and now she's on the registry.
well, the actual story, as I remember it, as best I can remember, was that he had been engaging in sex while he was living at her home, and then he took off and went and stayed with the person, or at some other place away from her home, and then in order to get him back, she reported him missing, and then she reported the stuff regarding the sex. But it was a little bit murky on the story to me as well. But the gist of it's correct. You've got the central point. Her crime was failure to report. Therefore, she's guilty, has some criminal culpability that's resulted in her being on the registry.
And she's been on it for 15-ish or so years. Her son was 14 and he's now 29, she said. So she, I can't quite figure out how she ends up on the registry for effectively doing nothing.
Well, the theory would be, I don't agree, but the theory would be that the victim suffered because of her failure to act, so therefore that somehow makes her criminally culpable for that offense. It's not a theory that I buy into because it's a dangerous thing if you take it to its logical conclusion. If you hold parents as kids grow up, you have less and less control over them. They're more and more rebellious, and I don't know how many you've raised, but they become more difficult to control as they get older. They're not cute and cuddly all the way through adolescence and through adulthood to adulthood. And so you cannot be responsible. You don't know everything they're doing, and you cannot know everything they're doing because they're not in your sight every moment of the day.
I kind of measure the time. I have a son, and I measure time by how long is it until he says, "I hate you, you've ruined my life." We are not there yet, but I anticipate the day will come when he will resent me for whatever, adolescent brain going through puberty, mind changing, whatever, he goes crazy. I will still love him, I will appreciate it, and know that I did similar things. But I don't know if you were listening to the clips that I played, but Emily Horowitz was like, kids have sex. They have always had sex. We had sex when we were kids, but now we have made that a criminal act. And I don't understand. I don't know. I'm just really bothered by how mom ends up on the registry for not doing something. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
It bothered me as well. I gave her some recommendations about possibly seeking relief from the executive of Virginia. They don't know all the powers of an executive in terms of pardon. She's obviously no longer serving a sentence, so there's no point of a sentence commutation. But a pardon could be a possibility, and with that pardon, it might erase the obligation to register. In some states, even that doesn't even erase the obligation to register. But barring that, the only thing that would save her would be a constitutional challenge, and we discussed that, but it's really bizarre. But the decision makers, the elected officials, we debate these laws all the time, and what I see happen in my legislative body is that no one actually confronts them and tells them what you just said. But what Emily Horowitz just was quoted as saying, they act as if they're somehow shocked that kids are having sex, and people need to say, "No, sir, you're not shocked. You did it," because they express it's surprising that 14, 15, 16-year-olds are engaged in sexual activity, maybe even quite a bit younger. But certainly by the time they're 15, 16, their minds are thinking about sex.
That
And
mechanism, that reproduction mechanism is ramping up. I mean, This starts to touch into a fine line between talking about it from a religious standpoint and like an evolution standpoint. But those hormones start raging, and girls wear seductive-ish clothing, not to victim blame, but there's attractions going on. There's pheromones, whatever you want to call it. People want to have relationships. They move from holding hands to kissing. Kissing moves to fondling. Fondling moves to the next step. It happens.
But it does happen.
But we have a society that has made that to be a thing where people are like, oh my God, I can't imagine my kid. It's like, what did you expect them to do? They can screw at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They can screw at 2 o'clock in the morning. It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, that just for clarity, it's within the Western world. I'm not speaking for the Middle Eastern world, but within the Western world, it's America that has the big hang up about sex.
Yes, absolutely.
If you go to the rest of the world, you don't, I mean, the Europeans look at us and they do not understand what our hang up is. They roll their eyes and they say, I don't understand you Americans.
Well, their hang up with us, like from their angle, if you want to like flip flop it, is violence. Like they'll have a commercial with a man walking naked to the bathroom, not in a sexual manner at all. He's just a dude. He's going to the bathroom. He happens to be naked, but they don't have the violence on television that we do. We'll put on a Steven Seagal movie or whatever, and he's freaking breaking bones and shooting at people and people's heads blowing up. We'll put that on TV, but anybody, you know, Ricky and Lucy couldn't sleep in the same bed.
And Jeannie couldn't show her belly button on the I Dream of Jeannie show.
The horror.
So I don't want to get too much into religion, but there's a lot of influence from the religious community that in terms of the morality police that we have that other Western nations don't have.
Is there hope for this lady?
There is hope. It would be slim hope. The executive is, even if the executive possesses the power, it's going to be reticent to act. This will be a nuanced case if the executive has the power, where it's going to be carefully scrutinized, weighing political ramifications if they were to grant clemency, and then the media were to get a hold of it, because these type of things are not secret. Be a pardon list, executive actions in terms of clemency of any type or public fodder. So the capital, the governor's coverage around the capital of Virginia, the press coverage would be potentially zeroing in on. So a sympathetic executive is also going to be examining the political ramifications of what if I do that. There'd be possibility. I think we have the on the same call the guest from Louisiana. He said that the governor of Louisiana just wouldn't care and is granting a lot of executive actions to take to give people commutations and even straight out pardons without regard to politics. But that's the rare executive,
right,
that'll do that. So that makes it a long shot. A constitutional challenge would be very expensive, and financial resources may be a problem. She said she thought she could raise some financial resources, but then she's got to worry about the shark bait. There'll be people out there that'll take her money and give her high hopes, and where there really are not high hopes and won't level with her. And I cautioned her against just be very objective about what attorneys tell you, because some will tell you the truth and some will not. And I'd like to be in the category of the ones that give you the best analysis that we can, that it's going to be a long shot. And you go into it thinking that it's a long shot rather than thinking it's a slam dunk, because it's by no means a slam dunk, even if they have the power to do it. In Virginia, and I don't know what powers the governor has. Like in the case of the governor of Georgia, they have very little powers. That's all vested in the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles. So in Georgia, I wouldn't even be making that recommendation.
Right. I've heard that. I've heard people describe that you can't even get the governor to help you because it's out of his hands.
They took that power away from the, there was the power was stricken from the governor probably in the 40s. I don't remember the exact time. I was not alive, but there was a lot of pardon corruption in Georgia, and they removed the power directly from the governor.
Yeah, I was going to say somebody had to F that up for them to do that.
Yeah, that's what happened. And since I can't say the governor, I don't want to blame a governor and be the wrong one. But
it's all right. He probably isn't here to defend himself anyway.
So, but his family shouldn't suffer from me picking the wrong one.
Yes, with our thousands of listeners, they're going to go hunt them down.
That's right. It could have been there was a Talmadge family dynasty in Georgia. And it could have been the Talmadge, and it could have been someone else. So I don't remember which one screwed it up.
So this first article comes from Reason Magazine, and the title is, "There are too many kids on the sex offender registry." And you got a big laugh out of this first paragraph. It says, "Both the boys admit that they did it, horsing around two New Jersey 14-year-olds pulled down their pants and sat on the faces of two 12-year-old boys. As one of them later explained, I thought it was funny, and I was trying to get my friends to laugh." So that turns into be a violent crime, and they are on the registry for life, if I'm not mistaken on how they... because this was, after all, sexual contact done for sexual gratification or to degrade or humiliate the victim. That's what it was.
It probably was, as best as a 14-year-old can formulate that intent and understand that. Or it was two 14-year-olds that were bored and thought that
they were certainly trying to humiliate, but it's just horsing around.
But 14-year-olds do crazy things.
Certainly.
And we expect these. My analysis is very simple. I find it shocking and appalling that any state in the union puts juveniles on a sex offender registry. It's appalling enough that they would do it to an adult, but it's even more appalling that they would do it to a juvenile. So you got 14-year-old children put on a registry for doing what, I don't know, I've not heard of that particular game, but there's games that kids do, and there's horsing around that results in people's pants being pulled down and their junk exposed, and that is just over the top. But unfortunately, it's the law, and we've got a number of states that are putting very young kids. I think a UN report of Human Rights Watch cited us for having someone as young as 9 on a registry.
Yeah, I think I've read something similar. But I mean, literally the way that's written, it says to degrade or humiliate the victim. They were certainly trying to humiliate him, but I mean, a lot of pranks are designed to humiliate somebody. If you put a bucket of water over the door and they walk in and they get splashed, you've totally intended to humiliate them.
Well, probably the drafters said that didn't plan for it to be used that way. They were probably thinking in a sexual term to
degrade and humiliate. Of course. They were thinking of something like, oh my God, what's it called? Where they post pictures after you've broken up with the girl. God, I can't think of what the term is at the moment.
That's revenge porn.
Thank you. Revenge porn. Something that's, I got to think that they were thinking in, along those lines.
But it's one of those things where we get criticized for trying to imagine worst case scenarios when bills are being proposed to change penalties or change language or create a new statute, a new crime. We always come in with horrible scenarios and people say, well, a prosecutor wouldn't do that. Yes, a prosecutor would do that.
Right.
They certainly would do that because they'll look at the black letter law as it's written in the book and they will say exactly what you just said, that clearly this was a act of humiliation. That's what the black letters say.
Yeah.
So I've got them. So as an example of why clarity, when you're advocating in your legislatures out there, that's one of the things you have to imagine. How could this be misused? And when they say that no prosecutor would do that, say, absolutely, a prosecutor would do that. Police would do that. They do it all the time.
Right. And it goes, hey, look, I've put 8,000 people behind bars for sexual offenses. Your city is safer. There are no details back there that they say they put these 14-year-olds in prison or on the registry. Your city is safer because of that.
Absolutely not. And I find this totally distasteful. And hopefully the 14-year-olds, as they grow up, will leave that state and go to a place where they wouldn't have to be on the registry. I don't normally invite people to do that because the obvious thing would happen would be you would see legislatures changing the law. But in the case of that one, that's a law that a lot of legislatures are not willing to change where they don't register juveniles. So if a person has been convicted of a juvenile, they go to a state that won't register juveniles. That's one way to get off of the registry. Because the state that convicted you that requires you to register has no longer has the control to require you to register.
And just to give a shout out to Emily. She was quoted in this article. If my child was victimized, I'd want to kill the person. But if my child was a victimizer, I also want them to have a chance.
And that would be Emily.
Emily Horowitz.
Just double checking. I knew.
Yeah. She's so very cool. We correspond on a halfway regular basis. So moving on, this is totally up your alley, is this is from the New York Times. Dissenting against the Supreme Court's rightward shift. And this is about the recently passed Judge Reinhardt from the Ninth Circuit. Is that right?
The Ninth Circuit, yes, the left coast, the huge territory of California, Oregon, Washington.
Yeah, I
Nevada,
did see.
That's got to be
like 25% of the U.S. landmass.
Alaska. It's the largest circuit geographically and in population.
So tell us about Judge Reinhardt. Sorry.
He was appointed back in the Carter administration. So that goes back almost to the end of, there are a few judges still that were appointed under the Nixon administration, but you're stretching back some number of years when you go back to the Carter administration. And Judge Reinhardt has been from the perspective of those who are accused of crimes or for those who are asserting prisoner complaints, as reliable of a judge as we could ever hope for. No judge is 100%, but he's been as reliable a judge as you could ever hope for to try to preserve due process for the accused and the prisoner's abuse. There's not a lot of sympathy for conservatives on the conservative side for prisoner issues. They should have thought about that before they got there. So it's a large court. I think I checked before the podcast a couple of days ago when I put this article in there that there's 29 judges, I think, on the circuit.
Okay.
So it won't be like the entire court is devastated, but they divide into three judge panels for deciding most decisions. So whatever panels he would have been on will suffer from having his intellect, and it will create a new vacancy, which will be filled. And I can imagine that you'll get someone that is far more conservative. They're going to be far more sympathetic to the arguments of the state in terms of those who have been accused of crimes, police conduct, search and seizure, Fifth Amendment, right against self-incrimination, confrontation clause. There'll be a whole lot of issues for that their sympathies will be a lot less, and they'll be more forgiving of misconduct along the way. And so it's going to have an impact on decisions coming out of the Ninth. But the great thing about
go ahead. Well, I was the section in there that caught my attention was his quote of the collapse of the habeas corpus as a remedy for even the most glaring of constitutional violations ranks among the greater wrongs of our legal era. A guy that I did time with, he was constantly working on a habeas corpus. And could you enlighten us on what he's talking about here?
Well, habeas corpus is the fundamental right that's been eroded through. Largely through reforms in 1996, and I'll take some responsibility from the side of President Clinton signing it. But see, people will always, if they don't agree with the policy, they'll say President Clinton passed. No, President Clinton did not pass.
Right.
A Republican Congress led by Representative Henry Hyde and other staunch conservatives passed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996. Otherwise, it never would have been on Clinton's desk. And Clinton was in the middle of a reelection campaign against former Senator Bob Dole. I think he was still in the Senate at the time, but anyway, Senator Bob Dole from Kansas. And that was in the middle of when we're still cresting in terms of criminality in America. And the arguments were that there was too many people using the federal courts to unravel their state convictions, and it was undermining our state courts. So they needed to make the process more streamlined and more difficult for people to get into federal court on state convictions. So they did that. They built all these hurdles and hoops to jump through, and it's very restrictive now. So a state prisoner that's alleging some defect constitutionally has a very narrow, small needle to thread in terms of getting any habeas relief, and it's very rare. Hearings on habeas petitions are extremely rare. Victories on a habeas petition are extremely rare. And that's all because of the changes in 1996, which was a conservative change, not a liberal. Mr. Clinton could have. He did possess the power to veto. He certainly did. But he would have been vilified in the reelection campaign had he done that. but he certainly did possess that power.
And that wasn't the Congress controlled by Newt at the time?
That was the Congress controlled by Newt at the time, yes.
You like said somebody chairman, else, though.
No, that was Chairman Henry Hyde of the Judiciary Committee.
Okay. I don't know who that is. All right.
You had the conservatives running the committees to process. So you had Hyde and Simpson Brenner from Wisconsin, but you had the conservatives firmly in control, and they gave us the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, and that's what Reinhardt is talking about. that we've effectively gutted habeas corpus relief, and that's a tragedy.
Is that part of where does the habeas come from? Is it constitutional, or was it added later?
I believe it's common law.
Okay.
Of the origin of habeas corpus, but I believe it also is in the Constitution. So I don't know the Constitution word for word, but I believe it's both.
I can't believe that.
Well, I can't know everything.
You're fired. We're going to move on.
That's right. Get rid of my kind and get some people in here that know what they're doing.
I would like that, especially when running the show. That would be helpful. I don't know that there's anything else that caught my attention in that article. Was there anything else that you wanted to elaborate on further?
That was really it. I think that the tragedy is that in the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to see all the federal judgeships that come vacant, and they come vacant for a couple of ways. They come vacant by the 100 that the Republican Senate refused to move through the process during the final 18 months of the Obama presidency. So those vacancies were handed, and there was about a 16, I think, at the circuit court level. And then you have retirements where they just out and out throwing the hat and say, I'm done, or they move to senior status, which creates a brand new judgeship. So if they retire, that creates a vacancy. And if they take senior status, that creates a vacancy because a senior status judge doesn't have to have a full caseload.
Okay.
So you've got years of drift of where we're going to be drifting toward a more conservative. Now, there's a lot of listeners out there who think that's great. And it is great if you don't care about the things that I care about, because by and large, you're not going to get much relief from conservatives on our issues. There are exceptions occasionally, like a broken clock, I say, is right twice a day. The late Justice Scalia was 100% almost dead on with confrontation. He looked at the Constitution. He says, confrontation, you have a right to it. I'm going to always come down that you have the right to confront whatever person is talking against you directly. So he was, but he was wrong on everything else when it came to criminal justice, other than confrontation. If you looked at his history of his rulings, his opinions that he authored, almost every time he was okay with police conduct, with anything else. So he was right on one thing. So if all you cared about is confrontation, Scalia was your judge, but he didn't help you on much else. So Reinhart wouldn't help you on everything, but he was going to be on in our corner much more often than a more conservative judge.
And just loosely, I don't know how much we've actually covered this in the past. I really don't want to make this into like a politics podcast, but generally speaking, Democrats are more in favor of criminal justice reform, second chances, social welfare, and social safety net stuff. Not to the point that it's all just a freaking handout that everyone's just walking around and they all get their $10,000 a year check, whatever. They're not, that's not their issue. But on the flip side of that, Republicans are, or conservatives are, more pro-business and less regulation, harder, tougher on crime, things of that nature.
Generally speaking, yes. As the parties have evolved in the decades of my life, there was a time, I was very young, but there was a time in the civil rights era that in order to pass civil rights legislation, President Johnson had more luck with liberal Republicans. There was a such thing as liberal Republicans back in the 60s. So he went to the liberal wing of the Republican Party and made up for the votes he couldn't get out of the Democratic Party to pass civil rights. But that was then, this is now. So you can't look back 50 years and say, well, the Republicans were right 50 years ago. They were right 50. Yes, they were right 50 years ago on civil rights. But they're not right now on much of our social policy.
And I can only personally attest to one thing. IML was introduced by a Republican senator from New Jersey.
Yes.
That's my sample size of one.
International Megan's Law, and that would be Representative Smith from New Jersey, who's a Republican. But if we go back to where we are in terms of the things that we hold dear, the explosion of the prison population, this is, and I just do more conservative versus Republican. I'll say it's a conservative agenda to drive the prison population. The crackdown on crime is something that got picked up steam. President Nixon ran on the Law and Order campaign in 1968, but he didn't get a lot of traction because he dealt with a Democratic Congress. He didn't get a lot of traction. The prison population at the federal level remained relatively unchanged during his 5.5 years. The federal prison population exploded in the Reagan years of the 8 years, because he was successful in passing the comprehensive reforms that he did in the 80s, which did away with good time, effectively. You only have 15%, did away with parole, and put in the sentencing guidelines. So the Crime Reform Act that Reagan was able to get passed, a Republican Congress, part of the time, Democratic Congress also part of the time, he was able to get those policies in place, and it led to an explosion in the federal prison population. And then through the succeeding administrations, even the Clinton administration, he was okay with making things tougher. He didn't veto a whole lot that he should have. He was not a liberal president, despite people's protestations to the contrary. We balanced the budget. We slowed spending to a very slow rate of growth during the Clinton years, and ended with 3 years of continuous surpluses to hand it off to the Bush to run us over the cliff again with large deficits. So Clinton was by no means a flaming liberal. He gave us things that I disagree with. He gave us the cap on welfare reform. He signed that into law. 5-year limitation. I disagreed with that. He gave us the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act. He signed that. I disagree with that. He signed the repeal of Glass-Steagall. I disagree with that. I can say I disagree with my people in my party. I find it kind of disheartening that people who disagree with the current president, they will just keep their mouth shut and they will never say they disagree.
Right.
I disagree with Democrats on a lot of things.
Well, rest in peace, Judge Reinhardt.
Yes, we will miss you.
Another article from Reason Magazine. This is kind of clickbaity, and I never quite followed in the article where they actually kind of where they got the title for it. And it says, writing sex offender laws based on fake recidivism numbers is rational, court says. The Illinois Supreme Court unanimously upholds a law banning sex offenders from parks. I don't know that they based it on the recidivism numbers, but they said we really need to dig into this rational basis. I know we've covered it before, but it hasn't stuck. What is rational basis again?
It's very confusing. Yeah. And it even confuses legal professionals. The rational basis, as I understand it, is whether or not the problem that the legislative body, be it city council or county commission or state legislature or the U.S. Congress, whether they are seeking to address a real problem. And our people want to say that the solution that they come up with has to be rational, and that is not a part of the rational basis test. So, and I go to the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, because to me, that's the thing everybody can relate to. Most everybody drives or is ridden in a car. It is rational to want to have safer highways.
Fair.
So that... If a person challenged the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit in the court saying it was unconstitutional, the courts would give that a rational basis review, and they would say, legislative body, what was your why is this a rational law? What was your basis for? We want to have our roads safer. That is the end of the inquiry. The courts don't get to go look and see if the result is rational, or if there's a better way to do it, because they're not super legislators. They don't exist to augment and offset mistakes that are made by your legislature, as long as they don't constitutionally intrude. So since you have no right to drive at all, it's a privilege, it's okay for the lawmakers to say, we will hold speeds at 55 miles an hour, even if it interferes with commerce, even if it causes road fatigue, even if it's all these things that court doesn't get to decide those. It's rational to want to have safer roads.
Just that's simply the by the assertion that we want to have safer roads. If it happened to be true that having all cars be blue made the road safer, then it at that point has passed the rationality test.
That would be correct. And our people want to dig into the results, because you can't show that this does anything in terms of the park restrictions. Now, please don't take this that I'm for the park restrictions. I'm not. I'm adamantly against them. Any restrictions on a citizen that's paid their debt to society, particularly, I'm against them. But the courts can't save us from bad public policy. Having a black robe doesn't entitle nullification of choices that we make by who we elect. And so that was the court saying, we don't exist to be a super legislature. I happen to think that there are times where the court should act as a super legislature. And I said that on a previous podcast. I think that there's a time when they should say, yes,
We are the only thing that stands between mob rule and the total obliteration of other people's rights to due process and happiness and whatever. So therefore, we are going to act as a super legislature, and we're going to stand in the way of mob rule, and we're going to say, no, you can't do this. But then that's a slippery slope when you start doing that. How many things do they get to nullify that you're in favor of because they were voted on by the mob? And I said, well, the mob, the majority of the people. The majority of the people want these park restrictions. They express that through who they elected.
Episode 14, by the way, covers the judges. But this was covered on the call the other night, and you and I have spoken that this doesn't burden a person very much with the amount of land area that they can't be present in by being a park. I think of there's a park, you know, 1,000 feet or so away from me. Okay, there's a park. All right, I can't go there. It's not that big of a deal. But in this article, they brought up, in addition to dog walking, because that's the person that brought the case to light, was a guy was walking his dog by a park. It also would prevent someone from hiking, photography, bird watching, fishing, swimming, bicycling, attending concerts, picnics, rallies, the Chicago Bears games, Soldier Field, visiting the Field Museum, the Shedd Aquarium, the Art Institute, Adler Planetarium, or the Museum of Science and Industry, all of which are public buildings on public land. That makes it significantly more punitive.
It does indeed, and that's where I've learned from the attorney that was on the call that this is a far broader prohibition. And not only is it far broader, it never ends. Even if in the event that the person no longer is required to register, if they timed out by whatever processes are available in Illinois, have they ever been convicted? So it's a lifetime banishment. So it's a horrendous restriction, and it should go away. But the court was saying that it is rational to want to keep the public safe. So therefore, under that standard of review, the intermediate level court had said it doesn't even pass that test. So therefore, we're declaring it facially unconstitutional. So they said no, mid-level court, it does pass rational basis review. So there's a surviving claim about it being ex post facto. So they're going to go back to the same 3-judge panel at the Court of Appeals and see if they now, having passed on the ex post facto, they didn't need to decide that. They can decide it on ex post facto. And she's optimistic that they'll come to the conclusion that it violates ex post facto prohibition.
All right. Can we can we play a little back and forth then? So I come to you and I say, Larry, we need to have our parks safer. You say that's rational. Right?
Right.
Okay. So, I mean, that's it. That's the end of the conversation. It passes the rational basis test.
That's pretty much it. I was having a thorough conversation with someone the other day. I said, it's rational. You can build fences around parks. You can put consternation or what do they call that wire? That's all razory type wire.
Concertina wire.
Concertina wire. You can put that. You could put magnetometers and have people check for ID. You could run them through the NCIC. There's a lot of things you could do to make parks safe. And if the public was willing to pay the price for that, they could do those things.
Okay.
And but you could argue that all that's for the one person who might slip through a park and do something that shouldn't be done, that would be a horrendous price to pay, and it would really make it inconvenient to use a park. But that's a policy choice. If you want to go through a magnetometer and have your ID run, then that's up to you. If you don't like that, then you call up your state representative and say, I can't believe that you're even considering this type of legislation. And if you vote for it, I will make sure I vote against you. You got that?
And then on the flip side, to take that further, none of our people then call our politicians or representatives and say, this is a really bad idea.
They hear from the victims' advocates and the law enforcement apparatus, as we've talked about. This type of legislation would be presented, and there would be virtually no opposition, if any. I'd say virtually. I can imagine possibly a defender organization who's overworked and may have one lobbyist. In the case of our state, we have the public defender. They have one lobbyist, and then they have volunteer people like myself that go in, and we try to tag team because there's too many things going on too many times simultaneously in the building. But you might have one voice of saying this is a bad public policy, and you've got the law enforcement apparatus from the Children, Youth, and Families Department saying it's good, the Association of District Attorneys saying it's good, the Sheriff's Association saying it's good, the Department of Public Safety saying it's good. You've got the victims advocate of whether different groups are out there, them saying it's good, and you've got the constantly whining defense attorney saying it's not good. So it's unfortunate, but the at the end of the day, they've heard horrendous amount of testimony in support of it, and only one person saying that there's something wrong with it, and that's the people who defend the people accused of crime. And we get sick of hearing those apologetic. All they want to be is apologists for people who don't play by the rules, and we're sick of hearing from them.
But so then let's take it that a nice, pretty family is in the park, mom with her kids, and they're pushing on the swing. They feel happy and comfy knowing that a sex offender, if he happens to be on premise, is going to be up Schitt's Creek. So she feels better that, hey, look, I'm in a safe place, right?
I suppose that's, to me, since most sex offenders do not emit radiation,
right?
There could
right,
be
right.
sex offenders. There could be sex offenders in the park anyway, despite the law.
But,
and in this case, there was.
But there could be a serial murderer who happens to have then been released, or a drug kingpin has also been released. These guys are also in the park, possibly a larger threat, but you don't know that they're there. It's not illegal for them to be there. What's the difference? And do you have a right to know that there's somebody there? I mean, this is kind of like, do you have the right to know who's next door? You don't have the right to know that you're at a city park, that the person over there is not going to end up violating some sort of regulation, some sort of rule, just by being present. You don't have a right to know that that person is doing that.
We don't have the right to know that that person has done something in the past. But the bigger question is, do people get to pay taxes in America for things that they can't use?
Well, for a long time, I didn't have a kid, so I paid school taxes.
Well, you paid school taxes, but you benefit from the education. The parks, I guess you could argue that the other people benefit from the use of the parks. But
definitely.
But the school taxes are quite a different thing. We all benefit if we take ourselves down to the level of Somalia, mm-hmm. our country wouldn't survive very long if our education degrades to
But we benefit by having things like parks or museums and things. We benefit as a society from having those kind of cultural experiences and shared spaces.
Yeah, but you're not forbidden to use the schools. If you have a kid, your kid can go to school. You just chose not to have a kid. So the schools are it's not a good comparison.
Okay.
You're not consuming school taxes because you chose not to, but you can enroll a kid at any time in a school.
Fair, but I also would then pay taxes to have a park, and now I can't use the park.
But that's my whole point. You're forbidden paying taxes. You're not forbidden to use the schools.
Okay.
So you may be forbidden to be on school property if you're on the registry, but your kid's not forbidden to be on
sure.
school property. Your
okay.
kid can use the school, and
sure.
that's another problematic area for restricting people on the register. From they should be able to fully participate in their child's education like any other parent.
Without a doubt,
I think we've learned that full participation produces a better result if they can meet with their teachers, if they can go to school events and outings and field trips. I think we've learned that. Hopefully.
I think so. It seems like that. I mean, that seems like it would pass the rational basis test.
So, but yeah, the rational basis test is very confusing because people want the result to be analyzed, and that doesn't. You don't have to analyze the result.
Well, what I was going to ask you then is, how does it get moved to the next level, the intermittent scrutiny?
You have to assert a broader constitutional deprivation, which is what she's probably going to do in this case.
Can you please provide an example? Can you use the speed limit example?
More fundamental constitutional rights. You don't have a constitutional right to drive. You have a constitutional right to vote. You have a constitutional right to go to church. You have a constitutional right to marry, as the court in U.S. Supreme Court said in Loving versus Virginia. So things that are fundamental, if they start restricting those, speech, you have a right to speech. You don't have a right to be heard, but you have a right to speech. So those type of fundamental rights.
How does it then apply to these parks and things?
Well, perhaps the argument needs to be shifted somewhat. The park could be used, depending on the rules of the park, for public gatherings to make public proclamations.
First Amendment.
Yes, and you could possibly pigeonhole in that way.
Oh, that's so. Doesn't that make it a slam dunk? Like the person can't participate in election, you know, if the politician is going to meet at the city park for a campaign rally, I can't go.
That would be it. But then you get to where you have, whether there's alternate, there's adequate alternate channels for you to get the information. So, but yes, there's less of a fundamental right in play here. So that makes it to a more relaxed level of scrutiny to the court. So the more fundamental rights are at stake, the higher level of scrutiny, and some of those strict scrutiny is where you've got prohibitions on speech, First Amendment, that'll get you very strict scrutiny.
I also, didn't she say something about like subways or something? They do terminate on some city park or state park property.
She did make something like that as an analysis that therefore they would have to get off at the previous stop because they would be.
Yeah, they would have to go up one or down, you know, up or back one stop to get to their destination. And now you end up with what we saw at the conference with Dubling putting up the maps with the big bubbles of, you know, you'd have to drive down the street weaving in and out of lanes and whatnot to not violate. So now this person possibly has to change their schedule getting to and from work or picking up their kids. Is there constitutionality in any of that?
Possibly so. A lot of these things have just not, lack of financial resources and creativity, they've not been properly developed. There's been extreme effort in this particular case, that this case has enjoyed a lot of support from
multiple voices.
Sources. But developing the cases in the beginning, putting forth the right claims, that's why it's so important that you not just launch a case for the sake of doing it, that you figure out where you're likely to gain traction and try to develop the financial resources to help you prove those points. Because a judge who wants to grant you relief, worrying about being overturned later, is looking for you to prove your case. And you have to do that by the clearest of proof. The burden is on you to show that the legislative body did something unconstitutional. They are presumed that they would never want to do something unconstitutional, so they enjoy the presumption that it's constitutional. And the burden's on you, not they don't have to prove anything. Their work is presumed constitutional.
Is the term here first impression? Is that the right word?
If it's something where there's no existing case law, that would be first impression. Where there's not any body of case law that addresses this particular issue. So when you have new technology developed. And 20 years ago, there wouldn't have been a GPS monitor that they could attach to someone's car without a warrant. So there would be no body of case law to look at. So the first person that says attaching this GPS monitor to my car as a search and seizure without a warrant, a search without a warrant, a seizure of information without a warrant, that would be an issue of first impression if there's no case law.
You had just said something that made me think of that word in the way that this was just talking about this, that it sounded like you were kind of delivering the message that this might be something of first impression where nobody's really attacked it.
Conceivably could be asserted. They would be different type of claims, but I don't know how many of them would be first impression. It would be that just hasn't been part of the litigation strategy. The advocates for the lawsuits, since they have very limited amounts of funds, they look for where they think the strongest claims are, which they naturally gravitate to ex post facto because that is in the Constitution. It is an ironclad claim to make that this is an ex post facto violation if you put these things on people, these restrictions on people after they've done something. So that's the easiest claim in their view. That doesn't work unless the court has determined that it's punishment, because you can make ex post facto laws as long as they're not punitive. So we're going to have to get more creative in the type of claims we assert, and it may be that the First Amendment may help on the parks. If you look at Packingham, they equated the internet to the public park. So it seems like the Supreme Court is sympathetic to what you might be able to use a public park for. So if I were in that particular situation, I would want to look at some of that dicta in the Packingham decision and see if I can argue that this is relevant for these park restrictions. But I think that the attorney is doing a great job, and I think she's going to stay doggedly in pursuit of this, and hopefully she'll win on the ex post facto claim that has yet to be decided.
That's neat. This is just really fascinating to me. Just, you know, I'm a computer geek, so I've never delved into any sort of law other than like thinking, well, that makes sense, or that's logical, that's rational. But hey, none of that really matters. Now you're mad at me.
Oh no, just waiting for the next shoe to drop.
Hey, Larry, do you know what is significant about this this episode?
It's our 6-month anniversary.
It is. This is our 20th episode, and thank you very much for joining me on this adventure, and I really appreciate it.
And our listenership is growing. You don't call it listenership in a podcast. You call it, what do you call it?
I call it downloads, but listenership is just fine by me.
So our downloads are going up and up.
They are. They're doing well. I'm pleased. I am pleased.
And that's why we need to encourage people to keep spreading the word.
Yes. I've been posting comments on the website. There were a lot of comments this week, too, people posting in things about the last episode from episode 19. And I've been trying to reply to them as best I can. And ultimately, please go out and share it. Please, please, please. We might start doing some sort of giveaway if you post a comment or if you can get someone to tag along and maybe post a comment or email in that you are the source. Maybe we'll start giving away water bottles or mouse pads or something. I don't know. I don't know that we'll do t-shirts unless things get just freaking out of control, because t-shirts are expensive.
Well, why don't we just give away thousands of dollars?
Well, that's within the budget, I'm sure.
Why don't we let's see the Koch brothers.
Oh my God.
Or the conservative. Why don't we contact the conservative?
They'll be right on it.
And say that we need funding to try to have more penetration to get the word out to the constitutional oppressions and see how sympathetic they are to our cause. Let's try that.
I just have to say that we're having a podcast that's talking about sex offender related issues, and you should not use the word penetration.
But you know, I think it's kind of amusing that everybody, they constantly blast the ACLU for not doing enough. And the ACLU, of course, what does that ACLU stand for? It's a union.
It's the American Civil Liberties Union.
Yes. So now America is diametrically opposed to union. We have unions. We have the lowest level of union membership participation in modern times. I mean, it's in the single digits as far as the private sector, and then it's not much more in the public sector. So Americans, by and large, hate unions. The organization has maybe 500,000-600,000 members out of 330 million Americans. They struggle to stay afloat, and they reflect the values of those 500,000-600,000, which are predominantly liberal. Predominantly. I haven't yet to meet a conservative who carries an ACLU card proudly. There might be one out there, but I haven't met him yet in my life. But yet, a significant number of our people bash the ACLU, and they come from a conservative group, and I always say, well, are you a member of the ACLU? And of course, they always say, no, they're not. Have you ever donated? No, I haven't. And I said, well, how is it that you're critical of a predominantly liberal group in every way? You say they're destroying America, that they're doing all these bad things to America, that they're keeping prayer out of the schools, they're taking the Ten Commandments down, they're making gay people in the head of the Boy Scouts, they're doing all these horrible things. How is it that you can call upon them for something like an important civil rights issue when you hate everything that they do? And I never get an answer on that one either. I mean, I would never reach out to Anita Bryant, if anybody's remembering Anita Bryant, if I were in the gay community, if I was in the LGBT community, and say, Anita, would you help us to get our rights? Because Anita was leading the campaign against homosexuals. It just, to me, I'm confused about it. So
yeah.
Anyway, that's my rant for this episode.
Very good. And so we had, like I said, we had a bunch of comments. So I snagged a couple. And so somebody wrote in, I think you're going to have fun with this. Why not file John Doe lawsuits? And this is related to the last episode about just ending the federal registry. So why not file John Doe lawsuits everywhere, since anyone filing suit has nothing to lose? I didn't
think
edit.
He means mentally.
I think he means monetarily.
Well, maybe monetarily.
How about this? Has nothing to lose. I would think and or those with something to lose have no interest in being a sacrificial lamb who gets harassed for being a plaintiff. My initial answer to that, and I wrote this in the comments, is even if you're a John Doe, the prosecutor still knows, and the prosecutor could still tell your handlers about it. They could still come and fuck with you.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
It just doesn't end up in the papers.
So the John Does are always known to the defending party. And I just think about this. I always tell you the law is logical. How well would it work if a lawsuit could be filed against you and the complaining party could be anonymous? How would you be able to research your files if you're running a business and you say, well, I slipped and fell. Well, who was, what day was, well, I can't tell you any of that. Well, who were, I can't tell you any of that. So if you file a John Doe lawsuit, it protects you from the public being able to download your name, but the sheriff's department or the state department of public safety or whatever you name as a defendant, they are immediately told who you are. That's the only way that they can defend themselves. And they are entitled, despite your protestations, they're entitled in our adversarial process to say, no, actually, we did not go out to his house 37 times in the last 12 months and leave orange flyers on his door. Our records indicate we went out there 3 times in the last 12 months. They can't check their files if they don't know who it is. So of course they know who you are. So the John Doe lawsuit doesn't do anything but shield your name from public disclosure.
But you'd still have to have some sort of developed case. You'd still have to, I mean, I guess you could do pro se and just file stuff arbitrarily in the court by yourself, couldn't you?
You can. It's not advised.
Of
You
course.
certainly can.
I'm just saying you
There,
could. I
there.
mean, we could just, do a denial of service attack against the system by just filing shit all over in all the counties and all the court districts just to, I mean, I'm not sure what the objective there would be, but I'm just using a hypothetical of that is a possible thing to do. Just, I don't see how it would work.
Well, it's a launch from the if everybody would stop taking pleas, if everybody would go to trial, the system would crash. I guess if you could file enough lawsuits and get enough templates out there, and people willing to go pay the various filing fees, and then you got to get your party served, and that costs you money. So if they were willing to pay the filing fees and the service fees and get everybody served, and they knew how when the judge orders the first because as a pro se party, you have an obligation. The court doesn't do the work for you, so you have an obligation to begin moving your case. So you've got to do certain things to move your case forward. So you've got to, so when the judge sets the first status conference and the judge starts issuing orders, you've got to follow them. So assuming everybody was willing to pay the money to get someone filed, get a suit filed, and get all the responding parties served, and if they could show up in the processes and be responsive to the court. But I just don't see it happening. I haven't met that many capable people. There are some good pro se lawsuits out there occasionally. I remember one in Maryland where I was impressed with the quality of it. There was a complaint. I guess I shouldn't name the person, but there was a complaint written by a guy, and he called in and said, "I've got this great complaint." And I said, "Yeah, so they all do." I said, "Send it to me, and I'll take a look at it." And I don't think I ever got it because I was probably a little bit too dismissive. And then first thing I know, I got a call from Nancy Forrester. She said, "We've got this complaint that the federal judge, or federal judge's law clerk, looked at it and took enough interest in it that he asked me if I would take the case." And I looked at the complaint then because of Nancy Forrester was saying it was a good complaint. So then I looked at it and I said, "Wow, this is a great complaint. I can't believe that he put together something this well organized, this coherent, and had this many viable causes of action." They ultimately decided to let him off the registry. That was after the first Doe case had been decided. And they decided that rather than he was launching new claims about separation of church and state and things they didn't want to go down, they decided that it was best to just let him go. So it does happen, but I don't see this model working for to inundate the courts with lawsuits.
Another comment was, I don't see them ever abolishing the registry. They found a gold mine and they're not going to give it up. I just keep hoping and praying that one day they'll realize just how cruel it is to punish these citizens so severely. I completely agree with the sentiment, but what are they going to abolish? We already talked about them abolishing the AWA, and that wouldn't change what the states do. And the states don't, they're not incentivized because the public would lose their minds if they got rid of the registry.
So, well, I'm a little unclear on the gold mine. What I think he or she is talking about is that the apparatus to monitor sex offenders on the registry is a fully funded machine. It involves a lot of personnel, and that may be that they're that th those jobs would potentially shrink. So that may be the gold mine. And then there is some federal funding available to help local law enforcement go out and check and monitor sex offenders. That may be the gold mine. But there's not a big pot of money for it in terms of it's not like when they make the sex offender registry larger that there's a big pool of money that comes flowing. So I'm not familiar with Maryland. The law enforcement unit that tracks the registry gets $250 per registrant. So there is a kind of a gold mine in Maryland. The state pays the local authorities, but that's one of the rarities. So I'm not clear on the gold mine, but I agree with him that abolishing the registry it's going to be a very tough act. And I've said that I don't want to go. I don't want to go as far as say I don't say they'll ever abolish it, because we can evolve. Our standards of decency can evolve, and I think we can evolve beyond this unfortunate chapter of American history that we've resorted to shaming and humiliating and making people third class, not even second class, but third class citizens. I wish there were statistics of how many people on the registry are working at either unemployed because of the registry, they're otherwise employable, or grossly underemployed, and we could somehow bring those into the equation about the mass suffering that's taking place out there. People that are living in the woods, living in tents, and working at sub minimum wage jobs in some cases, minimum wage jobs. It's tragic. I think you've met some people that have told you that they're working. One of our sponsors, supporters of the show, said he's basically working at a very very low level skill job.
A close friend of mine, he was working for a major international manufacturer of large equipment moving machines, and he was he I don't think he'd crossed into six figures, and now he's making, I think he just got 17 an hour, and he had been in the tens and $12 an hour for a long time, but he has worked his ass off to try and get himself moved up to something of a supervisory kind of position.
Well, I remember in Omaha, the when Nebraska went from a largely a private registry to largely, well, not largely, everybody's public in Nebraska now, after their 2009 amendments, which kicked in 2010. I was familiar with the story. I didn't know the man directly myself, but he was a mid-level manager at Conagra, which is a big processor out there in Nebraska, and I believe it's Conagra. And he was pulling down 6K, and when they put him on the internet, Conagra, if I've got that company right, could no longer keep him. They didn't want that kind of exposure, so they let him go. He ended up pushing a shopping cart around Omaha, and I went to Lincoln and testified, and I talked about that. I said, "Are you guys better off with this situation? A person was $100,000 a year plus, paying thousands and thousands of dollars in state and local taxes, and you knew where he was and he was stable. Now he's pushing a shopping cart around Omaha. He's at the Good Shepherd or whatever rescue mission they have that reach out to Jesus there, looking for some nights and some free food, and maybe on TANF, or not TANF, but whatever they call the food stamp, SNAP." I said, "Are you better off with this scenario? How's the public safer?" So it's tragic, but we don't have the public support. The public doesn't see these stories. They don't see that shopping cart going around Omaha, that man that was paying $30,000 a year in taxes previous to 2010. They don't hear that story.
What I would point our listeners to is a podcast from June of 2015 called Freakonomics. The title of the episode is called Making Sex Offenders Pay and Pay and Pay and Pay. And they go over with a whole bunch of stuff across the country of how much sex offenders end up paying once they do post-incarceration, including in their analysis was how much income lost being just a convicted felon and then through the registry on there. But I think, and the comment was made by Allie. Sorry for not giving you credit when this all started, but Allie made the comment about abolishing the registry. But what about all the money spent to particularly treatment providers that, and then polygraphers? You know, you're going to have state level requirements that you take a polygraph once or twice a year just for like a maintenance thing for talking specifically that this is a pseudoscience kind of device, and you've got to pay 250-ish to do a polygraph a couple times a year. That's $500. Over 10 years, it's $5,000 for a pseudoscience industry that doesn't really have a whole lot of work otherwise, except for something in law enforcement of making sure your FBI agents are being honest. I don't know what else a polygrapher would have reason to get involved with. I know that you've said that you've had interactions with them. You hire them on occasion.
We have, and I've had off the record discussion with the polygrapher, and he's of the camp that it is probably junk science. But what it has yielded in our case is that once people fail the polygraph, the same result, they tell the truth.
Right.
And so
Which is its intent.
That is absolutely.
It's just a bullshit. It's a boo game. It's a scare tactic to get you to tell the truth because you think, oh, the machine's going to know.
So that's exactly right, and that's he gave me some tactics of how how they would use psychological games to get people to fess up. So the gold mine is there. And so Allie, there is a gold mine there. I don't think it's the same kind of gold mine that there's all these massive funds coming in from government, although there are some, but it's a gold mine for people who make their living doing this work, and they're not going to want to let go of it. There's very few people who advocate for the demolition of their own jobs. You know, if you can think of
Right.
any, I'd like to put those on the comments of people who have jobs in particular industries who've advocated the demolition of what they do, and it's kind of thin, slim pickings I can think of.
But it is a gold mine for the politician to stand on a platform saying, I'm tough on crime and I locked up X number of people.
Well, it's a gold mine in terms of electability, but that's a reflection of us. When that only reflects about, if we didn't feel that way, they wouldn't say that. They're reflecting us. They would stand up and say just the opposite. They would stand up and say, and I tell you one thing, I'm going to do. I'm going to make sure that our prisons have the very best staffing we can find because we want to make sure these people are well equipped when they're released back into the population and they get the training that they need so they can be productive citizens. And I guarantee, I pledge to you today, if you elect me, I will do that. You'd get absolutely nothing but booze and rotten eggs and tomatoes tossed at you in most parts of this country if you gave that speech. So they're merely reflecting back what we want to hear.
And that goes to the quote that I used a couple episodes. There go the people, I must follow them.
So that is precisely, well, what the hell do you expect to happen in our system of government? What are you supposed to do? So flip your finger up when the people say, this is what we believe in. You're supposed to say, screw you. Screw you. I don't care what you believe in. It's all about what I believe in.
Yeah.
I mean,
Which
no.
we keep touting, and this is a major point of why I wanted to do this podcast, is elections have consequences. I don't care. Left, right, center, black, purple, green party. I don't care. Elections have consequences. If you vote for the guy that says I'm going to be tough on crime, we are going to get screwed.
That's my experience, and if we, and then what's even funnier is after you vote for those people, then you stay in denial about what they're doing, about their policies, and I point out to you, well, let's see, they've given the directive to seek the harshest charges that can be filed, to throw every habitual enhancement they can find, and so that's going to result in longer prison sentences. And they've also shredded the contracts with the halfway house providers on the tail end, so that people normally would get out 6 months in advance. There are not enough facilities now because I'm talking about the federal system. They're shredding, have shredded, terminated contracts with private halfway house providers. So they're slowing the exodus. They're increasing the amount of time people are staying, and you're going to get nothing but an increase in federal prison population. And I tell the people that, and they say, well, but I don't agree with them on everything. I have to vote for more important. Well, okay, well, I agree with you. I vote for the most important thing, but I look at the totality of everything, and I find that not only do I disagree with this administration on prisons, I disagree with them on the economic policy. I disagree with them on practically everything they're doing, because I think we're headed in the wrong direction. So I look at the bigger picture as well, and I don't see anything that excites me from this administration. I see voodoo economics. I see the deficit going through the sky. The figures are already showing that the deficit went up already in the partial fiscal year, and they're projecting it to surpass $1 trillion this fiscal year. And as far as the eye can see, it's back over $1 trillion, result of this voodoo tax cut and an increase, significant increase in spending. Yes, elections have consequences, folks.
But we're going to have increased economic growth, and that's going to offset those deficits.
We've tried that voodoo so many times.
Larry Kudlow is going to
And
save us.
yes, we've tried that voodoo so many times, and every single time the deficits have gone through the sky. They went through the sky under the Reagan administration. They went through the sky under the first Bush administration. They went through the sky under the second Bush administration. The only time they didn't go through the sky was under the Clinton administration, when they were brought into balance and ran 3 years of surplus. And then during the 8 years old Obama, the deficit came down from just shy of $2 trillion to about $500 billion for his second term, roughly on average of about $500 billion, which is still too high.
Can't you
But
attribute that to Republican Congresses? In both of
no,
those examples,
I really can't.
well, you had Newt in the Clinton one, and you had Paul Ryan and John Boehner for Obama.
Well, but you also had tax policies that brought revenue in. Clinton raised taxes, and the Republicans steadfastly said in 93 that those tax increases will kill the economy. and every single Republican voted against the Clinton Economic Recovery Act. And it was passed without any Republican support, and the economy thrived all throughout the 90s. Same thing happened under Obama. During the first 2 years, he put through tax increases because, boys and girls, we have to pay for the things we want from our government. And people want the services the government provides. But yet, we don't really have a problem other than we don't like to pay for things in this country.
That's why we have credit cards.
We don't like to pay for the things, but nobody wants to make the cuts. You know, grandma's Social Security can't be cut. Medicare can't be cut. The military benefits can't be cut. VA can't be cut. National security, I mean, we've hollowed out the military. We can't cut that. We can't cut national security, internal national security for Homeland Security. The terrorists would come in. We can't let people out of prison because they would take over our cities. I mean, nothing can be cut. We can't cut airport aviation. The things the federal government does can't be cut. We can't stop paying interest on the national debt. We got to pony up and pay our way.
Why do today what you can put off and do tomorrow?
Well, because it's irresponsible, and we're running up a huge debt. That when interest rates normalize, we will not be able to service this huge debt we have because the interest rates are so artificially low right now.
The only way to fix that, though, not necessarily the only way, but, you know, since we have an entirely new House of Representatives every 2 years, and we have a third of new senators every 2 years, we would have to somehow legislate that what is about to happen cannot be altered by the next Congress. Meaning we would have to put in some sort of 50-year economic policy of here's the bottom that can be spent, almost like a balanced budget amendment. And this then can't be gone against. Like, under no circumstances can this happen.
Well, there's a lot of advocacy for balanced budget amendments because we've proven it's very difficult for us to make the tough choices to balance the budget. People pay lip service to wanting to be fiscally responsible, but they don't want to pay the taxes and they don't want the cuts. Try doing any type of simple cut, no matter what it is.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the person that gets cut is going to scream like a stuck pig.
So there's nothing that can be cut that doesn't have a constituency of support. That's why we're doing these things. So the big ticket items can't be cut. They're sacred. So we can't cut the big ticket items.
And that's 2/3 of the budget.
Yeah, the only thing we can cut are programs where people really don't have a strong voice, and that's like TANF. You know, mm-hmm. Put all these work requirements so people can't get TANF. And
food
and
boxes,
SNAP.
Food boxes.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
You're going to get Blue Apron delivered to you by the government.
Do you know
Blue Apron is?
Yes.
Okay.
So it won't be Blue Apron what you get delivered to you. Blue
I
Apron,
know.
But
Blue Apron's fun. Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. To support Registry Matters on a monthly basis, head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at iTunes or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about us. We want to send out our big, heartfelt support for those on the registry. And don't forget to say, fuck you people. You fucking matter. You make it possible. All right, so moving on. We are never going to be able to do this justice, but we are going to try to talk about criminal defense and what would be mental disease or a defect defense. So I don't want to offend anybody, but you've got people that claim some sort of, what would be the terms that we're going to use?
Well, it's so relevant, Andy, it's a great topic because so many of our people are affected by this unknowingly. They are. So when we talk about mental disease or defect in criminal defense, it really hits our issue much harder than it does a lot of other crimes, and we can get into it a little bit more. But we're talking about not guilty by insanity, and we're talking about incompetency. We're going to try to talk about both a little bit tonight.
All right. So most of us have heard the terms like criminally insane or incompetent, but I got to think that most people don't understand these various terms, and they do mean something different in the court system.
They do, and a lot of attorneys don't understand it, and I get frustrated because if you're going to be in criminal defense, you ought to be able to articulate what the difference between insanity and incompetence is. They're both legal terms. They're not clinical terms. But insanity has to do with the person's state of mind and ability to form the necessary requisite criminal intent. We don't generally want to punish people who can't appreciate and understand that what they're doing is wrong and that they didn't intend to do it. But then the competency issue has to deal with whether or not the person is able to participate in this adversarial process that's going to take place. So it has nothing to do with the ultimate outcome of the trial. It's whether or not they get to go to the trial and go through the process. If a person's incompetent, we don't want to try a person who doesn't understand what's happening at some level. And it's a very low level, but we need you to understand what's taking place in the proceedings that are underway. And if you don't understand what's taking place, then the proceedings should not take place until such time as you have been rendered, treated, and brought to that level that you can understand. And sometimes a person's competency can never be restored.
I'm thinking of the old book of Mice and Men, where I guess it was Lenny was like the big brute, and he ended up killing somebody, and he was clearly, clearly mentally deficient, had no concept of what he had done.
So, well, the test for competency, if we take that issue first, is much different than the whether or not you're criminally responsible or you ultimately be found not guilty by insanity. So we're going to want to know, are you able to communicate with your lawyer? Do you know where you are? Are you with reality enough to know where you are? So you're going to need to know that you're in a court of law. You're going to need to know the basic roles of what the judge, the prosecutor, and defense attorney are doing. That you're going to need to know that your defense attorney is on your side and trying to help you and being your spokesman. And you're going to need to know how to communicate with that person so that you can go back and forth and banter. In an adversarial proceeding, there's things where you need to communicate with your attorney. And if you can't communicate with your attorney, that makes it very difficult. So it's a pretty low threshold. So if a person is so defective by mentally that they can't participate in the process, then they are usually committed to a psych ward to see if they can be restored. It may be that they can be restored, because it may be that they're not able to understand the proceedings because they're all doped up. And it may be that they're not doped up because they need their stabilizing medication, and then they can be coherent enough to be. So it may be that through treatment that they can be brought to a level of being able to participate in the criminal process. But then you get on to whether or not the issue of they're responsible for their criminal act. And that's where the plea of not guilty by reason of insanity comes into play if an attorney wants to assert that defense.
One area that we're not even going to touch on is the different avenue, really the nexus for this is a lady wrote in asking us to talk about autism specifically. And this is related to that, to being in some sort of depleted capacity. But you have bipolar, you have schizophrenia, you have manic depression, you have a boatload of things that could then fall under these things. And we're speaking very broadly about it. And I've just, you know, so if you had somebody that's schizophrenic, I mean, they're hearing voices and seeing things that are not present in reality.
Correct.
And that would fall under, I don't even know if that would fall under insanity or incompetent.
Yeah, well, it could be both.
It seems like it would straddle the fence.
Yes, the person could not be competent enough to ever get to trial, in which case a person who's incompetent and their competency cannot be restored, then the decision needs to be made on what to do with them.
Yeah.
Because they need to be, depending on the danger they pose to society, they may need to be committed to an institution for a long period of time. So then the question becomes, what does the system want to do with them? Well, they generally commit them if they perceive to be dangerous, they'll seek a long-term commitment to a mental facility and hope that someday that their competence is restored and they can actually put them on trial for the deed that they did. But if they never succeed, then they're locked away. But if they did something that was less egregious and less of a threat, a person who has a serial addiction to go out and expose themselves. And that's not the best example, but it's the first thing on my mind. We've gotten a lot more sensitive to that than we were back in the 70s and 80s. But a person exposing themselves, they haven't escalated to a behavior that really puts society in jeopardy. That's not a nuisance crime.
Fair enough.
Most people that see very few people have not seen someone's junk before. So you find it annoying and you wish they didn't do it, but it's not a life altering thing that you're going to be traumatized for the rest of your life. I've not heard any studies that said a person who had an episode of indecent exposure was traumatized for the remainder of their life. So that type of person might not seek a long-term commitment. But on the other hand, if it was a crime where you had significant damage, death, violence, they would probably want that person put away until they could be restored to competency, or if they couldn't, they would want them locked away for the rest of their life to die in the institution.
And we spoke before in the pre-show banter, that's my new term for the week, pre-show banter, about Andrea Yates and a handful of other cases where, in the case of Andrea Yates, which is just an unbelievably horrible event, she drowned her 5 kids in a bathtub due to postpartum depression. She got committed to an institution for even today, or did she eventually move on to prison?
She's in the institution as far as I know today. Now, that was not the initial outcome. She was tried and convicted. And then she was able, through using all those damn stupid appeals that people have rights to do, she was able to get another bite at the apple. And when she brought in this Dr. Part Dietz, I think his name was, if memory serves me, they were able to relate to the jury that they accepted that as a defense. Now, the defense of insanity doesn't do anything as far as relieving you of accountability. Because we don't put you in prison if the jury accepts that verdict, but we put you in a locked psych ward.
Right.
The difference is, in the locked psych ward, our goal is to keep you no longer than necessary to treat whatever caused you to do that, because it's treated as a mental health problem. So I don't know that she'll ever get out. I can't foresee the future. But I can tell you that people that surprise you do get out. The would-be assassin of President Reagan got out.
Yeah, but that happened in 1982,
81? 81, March of 81, I believe March 30 of 81. He got out. He got out recently. Mm-hmm. But the entire time he was at St. Elizabeth's, which I think they have already closed, or if they're not, the plans were to close it, they're going to convert it to a Homeland Security facility, but that was a D.C. area mental facility. He stayed there. They were treating him.
Right.
They were providing mental health care to him. He was gradually given more and more freedom. He was able to go home on passes and have unsupervised trips into town and report back to the facility. The goal of the hospitalization for Hinckley was to rehabilitate him and release him. That's not the goal of prison. If Yates had been sent to prison, the goal would be for her to die in prison for the rest of her life. She's theoretically receiving treatment. I don't know whether or not she'll ever get out, but the goal of a person who's found not guilty of the system is to treat them and release them when they can safely be released. That is supposed to be what happened.
From the public's point of view, she's off the street. She's not going to do that again to another set of kids. So why do we care?
Well, that's one way of looking at it. I guess the reason why we care is because we're a humane and we're a just nation. And if she had a legitimate mental illness that caused her to act out, and that mental illness has been successfully treated and she's in remission, I would hope that we would be somewhat forgiving. That's what we claim that we are in this nation, is we're forgiving. And I would hope that we would gradually try to give her more and more opportunity, like we did with Hinckley and others who are committed, who are found not guilty. It should be pointed out that this is a rarely used defense, and it's even rarer that it's ever successful.
Right.
The rules are so narrow that it's like it's worse than trying to find a needle in a haystack to assert this defense successfully.
But we've also completely decimated our mental health facilities nationwide.
Well, we have. We just, like I say, that's why St. Elizabeth is being closed, because we'd rather have a national security apparatus there than have the hospital. And I don't know all the nuances, so I don't want someone to write and say, well, actually, Larry, you didn't understand. That's not why they closed the hospital. But as far as I understand, that they're making way for Homeland Security. So facilities, and it may already be done.
But like in the 50s, maybe, I heard another podcast a few weeks ago about this subject. This is going to be a totally like fictionalized, exaggerated example, but there's an FX show called, I've lost the name of it, American Horror Story. And it was about a mental health ward. And it took place in the 50s or so. And oh my God, the treatment was horrible. But I've also heard that treatment in mental health institutions has notoriously been really shitty. So for them to have closed down under those conditions probably isn't a bad thing. But we left them with no alternative of where to put somebody that is actually truly in need of some sort of help. And I think it's statistically like there's a good portion of the population that does need some sort of treatment, mental health treatment, to a good degree in sometimes in their life.
Well, the facilities, as we look back in those years, those decades, the facilities were not good. Unfortunately, my family had experience state-operated psychiatric wards, and I can tell you that they weren't good. But that was a reflection of society's values. That wasn't necessarily a reflection. When you look at all the things that states have to fund, it would be, can you imagine yourself walking into a room, campaigning to run for your state assembly, saying, well, I'll tell you one thing I'm going to do. I pledge to you that I'm going to double the funding for our state psychiatric wards. You know, we treat the criminally insane there. And we treat the people that are not competent to stand trial, and we treat the people that are otherwise having difficulty in society, and we want to have the best services or the best facilities that money can buy. That just wasn't a message that, I mean, Rosalynn Carter, former first lady, she made that a priority when she was first lady of Georgia to try to improve mental health care. But it's just not one that you get a lot of traction with. So we ended up with woefully inadequate funded facilities, poorly trained staff, overcrowded facilities, and it was a lot easier to commit people in those days. So you had the convergence of two things where we always talk about bipartisanship, and I tell people it can be dangerous. That's how we got Glass-Steagall. That's how we got AEDPA, the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act. That's how we got a lot of things that have turned out not to be good public policy. That's how we got this mental health system we have today. It's because the conservatives were ready to spend less money, and the liberals were ready to give people more rights because of how badly they were treated in the facilities. So arguably, if you're free, you're better off than if you're in a facility where they're dictating everything to you and these horrible conditions they were in. So you had the convergence of liberals who wanted to free these people from this, what they saw as abusive and degrading conditions. And you had conservatives who didn't want to spend any money. So they were happy to say, yes, we'll close these. So bipartisanship can be a bad thing. When you get agreements for the wrong reasons to do things, sometimes you end up regretting the policy. I regret the policy of welfare reform of the 5-year limitation that President Clinton signed in the 90s. That was an example of bipartisanship at its worst. We have homeless, far more severe homeless problem now than we had then. People that did not magically get the skills to work in a modern economy, that don't have jobs, so we've got families, far more homeless families in America than we had back in pre welfare reform. To me, bipartisanship is not the answer to every problem.
No, certainly. But to me, bipartisan is a pseudonym for compromise.
Well, that's a different thing.
Different than bipartisan?
But compromise is different than bipartisan.
Oh.
If you just go in and agree to something because you want to be bipartisan, that's different than working out a hard-fought compromise where you're protecting some of your values and you're giving up something that you'd rather not have to give up, but you're protecting some of your values. I don't know whose values got protected when we emptied out our mental institutions and we didn't provide any community care for these people. I'm at a loss to know how we benefit as a society. We've got our jail wards filled with a jail of correctional facilities providing the services of makeshift psychiatric wards all across the country with significant percentages of their inmates that need psychotropic medications. And that's all they're getting as psychotropic drugs. And I think you can testify, you can be firsthand experience of how widely distributed psychotropic drugs are in the correctional facilities. But what real treatment? Is it happening?
No, not to my knowledge. I mean, you don't go around and talking, hey, man, how was your crazy doctor today? I mean, you know, you don't go around talking to people that way. They just go to pill call and they go get their, forgive me for using the crude terms, but, you know, hey, go get your crazy drugs or whatever. But there was one guy who was like, if he just chose to, like, bail out on taking his meds, he would get violent. And that's, you know, now you're in a locked cage with somebody that is, there's no restraint for somebody like that. They're going to fight and fight and fight until someone is severely injured or the CERT team comes in and tases the guy.
Mm-hmm.
That's really humane treatment.
Yeah, well, see, in a psychiatric ward, you have those same issues in a psychiatric ward. I haven't spent much time in my life locked in one, but it stands to reason that you would have those same type of issues. But the response is a lot less aggressive. You don't come in and tear gas people. You don't come in and tase people. You don't come in and put people in leg irons. You use soft restraint. You use leather restraint. And you use a calming environment. You use a different type of technique when you're trying to get control. But you do have to physically restrain people in psychiatric facilities. I mean, it's not to say it's a panacea that everybody, that they just use verbal judo.
I mean, if somebody's going to get violent, you have to figure out how to diffuse the situation appropriately. But when you have a room full of 80 dudes, many of them are quite willing to fight. I can't imagine that in a psych hospital that they would have them in open dorms, with 80 dudes just like ready to freaking pounce on the first guy that looks at them cross.
So, well, you do have more than one person in a psych ward, but the way they handle issues of aggression is completely different, and that can even be different within correctional the model of the correctional facility in terms of how I always cite the old Boulder County model. I don't know how much it's changed in the decades, but they used much softer approach in their county jail to defuse bad situations. But the jailhouse, the correctional facilities are not equipped. They should not be the substitute for good psychiatric care, but they have become the de facto. There's nowhere else for these people to go. They're out on the street with nowhere to go. They're subjected to a lot of nuisance type of crimes, like urinating in public, sleeping on a bench in the hours after the park's closed, and things that get them arrested for very minor crimes. And they have issues. So when they get to the jailhouse, when they go through the medical intake, they get classified as having mental health issues, and they end up getting their pharmacy call, and that's the treatment they get while they're in jail. But that's not where they really belong.
The use of this defense has declined over the years. How come?
Declined because it never was widely used, but it's declined because of high profile cases like with Reagan. And even the Yates case, the every time there's someone's perceived to get off for doing something heinous, there's a rush in legislative bodies to further restrict the not guilty by insanity defense. And it's a tough one already, because when you assert the defense, you are already admitting that you did the deed. It's what we call an affirmative defense. So right. You are affirming that you did kill the kids.
I did it, but I'm crazy.
But I should not be held criminal responsible because I did not have the prominent two components of the test, or did you have the ability to understand the difference between right and wrong?
Yeah.
And then if you pass that part of the test, then the other component is, well, even if you did understand the difference, did the mental disease or defect render you incapable of conforming your conduct to the requirements of law? And it breaks down for most people there, because they if you manage to get past a tall order of showing that you didn't understand the difference between right and wrong, and usually your actions will help show that you understood the difference between right and wrong. If you go out and do something bad and you hide the evidence, there'd be some reason why you hid the evidence. If you didn't think there was anything wrong with what you did, there would be no need to hide the evidence, would there?
Nope.
So the evaluator is going to look at them and say, well, let's say you cut the phone line, then you came in house and you stabbed the person 36 times. Then you took the knife in and you cleaned it off.
But Larry, they fell on it. They repeatedly fell on the knife.
And then you wore gloves so that you didn't cut yourself.
Or leave fingerprints.
And so you did everything you could to make it look like it. And so that breaks you down right there, because you had the ability to plan and you knew that your behavior was wrong. So then it only has any hope, if it has any prayer of working, that you have to show that you couldn't conform your conduct to the requirements of law because of a mental disease or defect. And it's just such a tough one to overcome. Jurors are not going to be sympathetic when you've done a crime. You're not going to assert this type of defense in a very minor crime, typically, because the minor crime, the penalty would be a lot less. There was a potentially of many years of confinement in a psychiatric ward.
Right,
You know,
right.
Hinckley spent 30 years in there. You could spend, if you're doing serial shoplifting and it never can go beyond a misdemeanor, and the most you're looking at is 12 months, and you
Right.
do 6 because of good time, and you say, well, I can't, I've got an irresistible impulse, which that component of the defense is largely from a bygone era. But if you say, I couldn't help myself because of my psychiatric condition, you might end up serving more than 6 months in the if it worked before you got released. So it's a dangerous defense to assert in a minor crime. So it only gets asserted in the most serious crimes. And then you have very skeptical jurors who can't go back and look their neighbors in the face saying that they let the poor, because it's perceived as letting them get off. So you just let Andrea Yates get off. Can you imagine the phone calls that those jurors got if their names were released that found her not guilty by insanity? Can you imagine the ridicule that they took?
Yeah, no doubt.
So it's not a defense that's very often used, and it seldom works.
Because it would, I mean, yeah, it would have to be for only the most heinous of, and then there's going to be a significant amount of scrutiny against the case to make sure that you just kind of snapped one day and did it. I guess I mean, a probably a fairly common one would be I walked in on my wife having sex with another man, and I snapped, grabbed the gun, killed him. So, and I'm losing my brain on which how
Well,
to term that.
that's a
Temporary.
temporary
Thank you.
insanity.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, and that seldom works, but it can.
Okay.
It is one that has a chance of working.
It
It,
seems
you
like that
you
would
can.
be something that works way more often than in these, like the Andrea Yates as the example.
Yeah, you can get a sympathetic jury. You're more likely for that to work. You're more likely to get a nullification than you are an insanity, because you've got a person who was fairly normal. They worked 40 years at the Ford Motor Company assembly plant, and they found her and he found her in the arms of a 22-year-old buff
Yeah.
stud, and he kills the guy. That's something you can relate to on an emotional level. And the guy's not going to come in and say that I've had all these deep, I've been, I had postpartum and I've had all these problems. He's going to come in and say, I just snapped. And so although he's not mentally diseased or defective,
Right.
he can get an expert to say that the outrage made it beyond the ability to control, and you might get a jury to buy that. It seldom is asserted as well, because but that is something a juror could identify with. You can't tell me when you find somebody who can relate to drowning five kids.
I got nothing on that one.
I don't think I can find anybody. I've tried. It would be hard to find someone who can say, well, I could relate and understand that. I don't think you can find a juror that could relate to that.
Well, I'm sure that women after and then going through postpartum depression, I'm sure many of them could relate to the thoughts, but they could never bring themselves. They say they could never, but obviously somebody did. They can't relate to the actual then going through with the action. I mean, that's what a lot, I mean, you know, a lot of people contemplate all kinds of sorts of crazy things, but they never then move anywhere near executing on those thoughts.
So, well, this for our issue in the sex offense arena is because we have people who have mental development, mentally developed, they're delayed. I
Yeah.
think that's the politically correct term. So you have people who are older and they're mentally delayed in their development, and they get involved in a consensual sexual relationship that they didn't understand was criminal because they were mentally delayed in their development. That is a problematic defense, because you're 22, you're mentally 15, but you're 22 years old, and you have sex with the consensual sex with the 15-year-old, which is way too many years apart. So we have cases where people end up in the system like that, and there's really not much you can do. You can use that as mitigation to argue to the court that they deserve a probated sentence, but that's not really a not guilty by reason of insanity defense that's going to be a viable one. But we end up with a lot of people that are in the system because of their delayed development, and it comes across in child porn conviction. You know, they didn't think there was anything wrong with it. I mean, they went on the computer and they were looking at these pictures, and they're older, but they relate more. I mean,
Right.
if you're 22, you're mentally delayed in your development. Maybe a 14-year-old doesn't look so bad to you. Maybe a 13-year-old doesn't look so bad to you. So they don't see anything wrong with looking at those pictures. But the system does.
Yeah,
so,
because so you're 22. But yeah, I mean, we could circle back around. I mean, there's all kind, like a 15-year-old could look like she's 22. Wouldn't the consequences go the other way? I mean, should they then go the other way? I mean, the girl or the guy, whichever, acts older, looks older. Everything is older except for the physical age. We won't make that leap either.
Not sure I'm clear on that. Well,
it seems like if you can have the 22-year-old be mentally young and convict, you should then, I guess it's a better analogy of taking that you're going to prosecute an underage child as an adult. You should be able to elevate the child up to being adult. I've kind of changed issues, but I think what I'm trying to get at is that this is why judges should have the leeway to adjust how their sentences go, but we have mandatory minimums.
Mm-hmm.
So that if the judge should then be sympathetic to somebody's being, hey, look, this guy is really mentally 12, 15 years old, and he's doing this with a younger child or looking at pictures of young kids, doesn't deserve all this. Plus, the system that they're going to put him in is not designed for a mentally 14-year-old person to be in it.
That's where the next broadcast we hope the podcast we hope to do to focus on the question is that we bring these people in to the system that have these mental challenges, and they are not equipped mentally to deal with, I mean, it for a person who's fully mentally developed to go through what they go through as a sex offender, being placed on the registry and all the hoops of the polygraphs. But you take a person who's delayed development or autistic. You know, I have a family member with that, and so I have a limited amount of understanding of autism. But they just couldn't navigate. My sibling could not navigate what would be expected of them. But then they get violated because they can't comprehend what they're supposed to be doing and understand. Right. So I'm very sympathetic to the person and the autism. Our system is not able to handle these people, nor should they be in this system. That's the whole point of the podcast, is that we don't have the alternatives, so the correctional system has become the substitute for what there should be. We shouldn't be dumping these people in the correctional system, but we are.
Yes. We've run very long. Larry, you committed to doing another 20 episodes?
I guess we can do 19.
All right, cool. Larry, thank you very much. I appreciate it, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Andy.
Bye.